From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Every 4 years, the race for the White House becomes priority number one for news organizations. This week, the three major television networks have assigned not just reporters, but anchors to follow Barack Obama during his current trip abroad. Some critics are saying that John McCain didn't get the same kind of coverage on a similar trip and are calling this media bias towards Obama. What do you think? We invite your opinions on our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. But before you answer, consider this. The 2008 presidential race has already gotten an unprecedented amount of media coverage overall. That's what media analyst Andrew Tindall says. We'll talk to him in a moment, but first, we wanted to explore our own rules of engagement when it comes to presidential coverage. Ron Elving is with us. He's NPR's senior Washington editor. Hey, Ron.
Good to be with you, Farai.
So this is an exciting moment for us to take a look at ourselves. So, you know, first of all, how do you compare this presidential race with ones in the past?
Can't do it. This is not like any presidential race in the past. We have already had the first woman candidate to be this close to being nominated, the first Hispanic candidate to be a major candidate, first Mormon. We have the first African-American nominee now, presumptive nominee in the Democratic Party. And we also had a very interesting race on the Republican side that would have been kind of a barn burner in its own right. So this has been a much more interesting presidential race than we've had in my lifetime. And it's just got an awful lot of facets of great news value.
So how would you say, what would you say even coverage is? What is the goal, really?
The best thing you can do is to reach the end of the campaign and have people say, well, we got a fair look at the candidates from the beginning to the end. We got a fair look at the two nominees of the major parties. We got a fair look at the third party candidates. And we got a fair look at all the competitors back in the primaries. I don't think you can say that it all is going to be exactly the same number of minutes devoted to each. For example, Bob Barr, the Libertarian Party candidate, will not get nearly as much coverage as the two major party candidates. And we will try, but we will probably not achieve absolute perfect mathematical equalness of numbers in the minutes and seconds devoted to each of the two major party candidates, but we will try.
So NPR's White House correspondent Don Gagne is with Senator Obama in Jordan today. So is his reporting there going to get the bulk of the news today?
Not really the bulk. There'll be a four-minute report from Don Gagne on All Things Considered tonight. We did get him briefly into the newscast that you just heard a few moments ago. And we did get a little bit of an update to what he had done for this morning's Morning Edition. But we also had a discussion of John McCain's campaign on in Morning Edition right after that. And there will be a discussion of what John McCain is saying right this minute at his town hall in New Hampshire on that same All Things Considered tonight, of about the same length as Don Gagne's report from Amman, Jordan.
Well, let's broaden this out a little bit to other folks' coverage again. So there's reports that say that the New York Times returned an essay that Senator McCain wrote and told him it needed edits. He wrote the essay as a response to an op-ed that Senator Obama had published in the New York Times last week. So the Times said that's just part of their editorial process and more details were needed for McCain's piece. Tell us a little bit more about NPR's editorial process with commentaries, and we'll go back and talk about the Times.
Well, we have a commentary policy, too, in which if somebody sends us something they'd like to read on our air, we take a look at it and we say, yes, we'll put this on, or no, we won't put this on, or most often we'd put this on if you're willing to take a look at this issue and that issue. In the case of what John McCain wanted to put on in response to Obama, the New York Times said, can you tell us what you mean by victory? And John McCain said, no, I want to just have it run exactly the way I wrote it. Well, he's published seven previous op-ed pieces in the New York Times, so he knows and his staff knows that the New York Times frequently writes back and says, we'd like this tweaking, and that's the price of poker. If you want to appear on the op-ed page of the New York Times, that's not a citizenship right. It's something that's up to the New York Times. So you don't want to play ball with them. You're probably not going to get that particular print space.
Overall, how good do you think we as a profession are at looking at ourselves in the mirror when it comes to things like bias, whether it's about political coverage or other issues?
I'm sure most people would say we're not very good, but I would not say it's for lack of practice. because we are looking at ourselves in the mirror almost constantly, too much so, I would say. We probably go too far in trying to correct, and we overcorrect. Our goal is to be as even-handed and fair to all the candidates as we can be, but we are also sure that it's going to fall short of that goal in the minds of those who feel strongly about the relative value of the various campaigns. If your campaign gets covered a lot, you're probably going to think that was a good measurement of coverage. If it doesn't get as much, you're probably not going to feel that way. But we still have to look for as many objective measures as we can, minutes on air, number of stories, positive, negative, and we do that all the time.
Now, with all that said about media bias towards Senator Obama, CNN's poll of polls show he's only 4 points ahead of Senator McCain. So what do you make of that?
I think it means that the voters, or the people being polled as voters, don't take their cues from the media, which is not really hard to believe. I think most people absorb a certain amount of media information, that they choose from certain sources of media information. They generally tend to go to ones that they find simpatico. They may agree or not agree with a lot of what they hear, but they make up their own minds, and they make up their minds on the basis of things that were in their minds before they went to the media.
Well, Ron, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Farai.
Ron Elving is NPR's senior Washington editor. He joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. And now we're going to turn to media analyst Andrew Tyndall. He's the publisher of the TyndallReport.com, which analyzes the three major networks' nightly news coverage. Welcome back to the show, Andrew.
Hey, Farai. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. So, big question. Is Obama getting more coverage than McCain?
Obama is getting more coverage than McCain by an order of magnitude. Since the primary season ended, which is really the first time the two have been head-to-head and the contest with Hillary Rodham Clinton hasn't been in the way, on the nightly newscast, Obama has got more than twice the number of minutes than John McCain. He's an absolute media phenomenon.
Does that mean that McCain is getting less coverage than is normal for a presidential candidate?
No, absolutely it does not. There's no way that you could say that McCain is being undercovered compared to the norms of previous campaigns. I've been looking at the nightly news now for 20 years, so I've got the numbers for the amount of time on the broadcast network newscasts for five previous campaigns. And in fact, McCain has gotten more coverage this year so far than any previous Republican candidate in any of the previous five campaigns. So it's not that McCain is being undercovered, it's that Barack Obama is getting coverage the likes of which we have never seen.
Well, we just heard Ron Elving, our own NPR Ron Elving, saying that this is just it's kind of a format breaker of an election, that there's all these factors that you don't have in any other historical election. Do you agree that that's part of the issue here?
Yeah, the election itself is a format breaker, but also I think the style of journalism has also adapted to comply with the fact that this is such a dynamic election. I think what's happened is that journalists, television journalists anyway, have learned their lessons from the latest genre of television that's in entertainment television, which is the reality game show, a format that's become popular over the last four or six years or so. So this is really the first election where they've been able to take the lessons from Survivor or the American Idol or Big Brother and apply them to political journalism. So basically, this campaign is being treated as a contest between larger-than-life personalities facing ordeals, and we're going to find out who's the last one remaining on the island.
Do you think that approach is driven by the audience, if you can put it that way, the voters, or is it driven by the media?
I think this year the actual candidates are larger-than-life candidates, and I think they lend themselves to this approach. Ron said earlier that we have new demographic groups being represented in the leading candidates, but it's more than that. You've got archetypal larger-than-life characters that the campaign can be used to discuss things that are over and beyond just where a particular party's position might be on gasoline or Iraq or things like that. We're talking about huge issues here, like, you know, what's the difference between the generations, between the Vietnam War generation and the younger generation? What's the role of African Americans in leadership in society? Is there a glass ceiling for women to break through? These are huge societal issues, and they're being represented by these larger-than-life candidates.
Speaking of archetypes and demographics, when it came to the primary season, how did Senator McCain stack up not just against Senator Obama, but also Senator Clinton?
Yeah, absolutely. The best way to see the primary campaign, the first 5 months of this year, is really to see it as a three-way race rather than a two-way race. And basically, the major contest was between the young, attractive, good-speaking, oratorical black man and the experienced, glass-ceiling breaking woman. And the wily, grizzled vet came in had a third-place role there, but nevertheless got some coverage. If you want to rank the number of minutes that they got, Obama got most, the Rodham Clinton got second, and McCain got about half as much as Obama got.
All right. Just very briefly, what do you see ahead in terms of the parity or lack thereof for Obama and McCain?
Yeah, I think what Ron said about at the end of the day, he wants to see all the candidates treated equally. His wish will not be fulfilled, is my prediction. And as far as I can see, this election is an election where Obama is getting all of the scrutiny. Now, when you said media bias, I don't want you to think that this means he's getting all the scrutiny and that scrutiny is positive. He's getting positive scrutiny, he's getting negative scrutiny, and he's getting scrutiny about trivial things that are not normally newsworthy. But my prediction is at the end of the day, this is going to be an election where it's going to be about Barack Obama. Is he qualified for the job? If he turns out to be, he'll get elected. And if he turns out not to be, then McCain will be elected.
All right, Andrew, thanks so much.
Great to talk to you, Fry.
Media analyst Andrew Tindall. He's the publisher of TindallReport.com, which has been analyzing the network's nightly news coverage for 20 years. And we want to know what you think about the media's coverage of the presidential candidates. Go to our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It's time now for our Africa update. This week, Zimbabwe's leaders agree to hold talks to resolve the country's political crisis, plus the U.S. Senate votes to lift a ban on visitors with HIV, and a look at how Africa's oil affects the cost of gas in America. For more, we've got Charlie Cobb. He's a senior analyst for the website allafrica.com. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. How are you?
I'm great. So let's start out with Zimbabwe. President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai have signed a memorandum of understanding. It means they've finally agreed to discuss ways to end the country's political and economic crisis. So South African President Thabo Mbeki helped broker the agreement. Here is what Robert Mugabe said about the pact.
We sit here in order for us to chart a new way of political interaction, that we assist each other to overcome the political and economic situation which requires support.
Now, Morgan Tsvangirai also spoke after signing the deal.
We want to make sure that every Zimbabwean feels safe. We want to share a common prosperity for everyone, and we want a better Zimbabwe. Always must bear in mind the mother and the child who goes to sleep without food, the people that have been brutalized. I hope that that will be the world of the past.
Charlie, what does this really mean? Is this a sign of change for the people on the ground?
Well, it's a first step. I think one of the South African newspapers called it a dawn of a possible new era. If you read the memorandum of understanding, it's not very specific, although it sets a remarkably short time frame to do a whole lot of things, end political violence, or at least begin to end political violence. begin the design of a new constitution, start promoting what they call national healing and cohesion and unity. All of these are supposed to be discussed and substantially resolved in about two weeks. What's really interesting about this memorandum of understanding or this deal that's been reached is an almost U-turn by Robert Mugabe, who had said none of this was necessary.
Now, many world leaders have said that they don't recognize Mugabe or his government as legitimate. Do you expect that to change? And how will the international community, you think, interact with any kind of coalition of these two opponents?
Well, they'll wait. The international community will wait for at least the 2 weeks to see what emerges out of these conversations, which I should say are going to be essentially brokered by Africans, both Africans in the Southern African Development Community, Thabo Mbeki as president of South Africa, Haile Menkerios, who really is the Africa guy at the United Nations. They'll wait and see what emerges. This does not mean that Robert Mugabe's government will be recognized as legitimate, but a government in which Tsvangirai has agreed to become a part of would be recognized as legitimate by the international community.
Now, this deal came on the same day that a new banknote went into circulation. It is a $100 billion banknote, and it's about enough for two trips on a bus or two loaves of bread. What does that say about how much work these two men have to do to try to pull this country together?
Well, with an inflation rate, I think it's officially as of this week 2.2 million% per month. The numbers themselves demonstrate the enormity. And that's going to be one of the big issues. Who gets the power to begin tackling these issues? How much blame is going to be put on the West? Mugabe is putting a lot, for instance, on the West. He's even talking now about nationalizing corporations that go along with proposed Western sanctions. They're starting, as the Eritreans used to say, from below zero.
Well, let's move on. The U.S. Senate voted to repeal a travel ban on HIV-positive visitors or immigrants to the U.S. Now, that ban was imposed more than 20 years ago. It required foreigners with HIV to apply for special waivers to enter the U.S. And people who have all sorts of other infectious diseases have an easier time than those with HIV, even though now there's, you know, so many treatments, long-term treatments. So why was the ban adopted, and what's the significance of it now being ended?
The ban, which was first adopted or imposed by the Immigration Department, and then I think in the early 1990s, legislated by the U.S. Congress, grows out of fear and hysteria over HIV/AIDS. I mean, that's what drove that in 1987. There's no rational reason to have this ban. And in fact, HIV/AIDS is the only disease explicitly named in any of the government regulations concerning immigration. And that's hysteria. That's all that was. There's one issue that still remains. There's still argument in the Congress over this, particularly among Republicans who now say easing these restrictions would cost too much money. And, you know, I'm not sure how that calculation is made. The Senate bill actually proposes a rise in visa fees, I think $1 for the first 3 years and then $2 over the next 5 years. The House bill has no such provision, so that argument still remains.
Charlie, we only have a minute or so to talk about this, but want to mention that, you know, oil, big issue. Most people think we get the bulk of our oil from the Middle East, but we get millions of barrels of oil from Africa every day. We're going to hear in just a minute about Nigeria's oil industry. And what's the significance for Africa? Has the oil produced gains for African nations?
Well, no. It has not. Nigeria, which is, of course, comes immediately to mind, which is the biggest oil supplier to the United States from Africa. For all the billions Nigeria makes from oil, the per capita income in Africa is a dollar a day. And in chunks, sections of the country, it's even less than that. It hasn't meant anything in the sense of the alleviation of poverty in Africa. And there, Africa may be the next great source of oil for the entire world. Right now, I think it produces about 9 or 10% of the world's petroleum, but that number is growing every year. And already we're watching a competition between the United States and China in terms of African oil. Well, insofar as the price at the gas pump is concerned, that depends a lot more than the simple supply of oil from Africa.
Well, we'll pick up on this next time. Charlie, thank you.
Thank you.
Charlie Cobb is a senior analyst for the website allafrica.com. His latest book is On the Road to Freedom, a guided tour of the civil rights trail, and he joined us from member station WJCT in Jacksonville, Florida. The next time you fill up your tank, the oil may have come not from the Middle East, but Nigeria. It's one of the top producers of oil in the world and a major supplier of oil to the U.S. Now a book called The Curse of the Black Gold documents the pollution, violence, and lifestyle created by the oil industry in Nigeria's Delta villages. Photojournalist Ed Kashi has traveled throughout the Niger Delta, and his pictures are featured in the book. Also joining the conversation is Omoyele Sowore. He's an expert on Nigerian oil and publisher of the website Sahara Reporters. Ed and Omoyele, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello.
Thank you for bringing us.
So, Ed, this book, this photo-heavy book, also a lot of text, a lot of information, the subtitle is 50 Years of Oil in the Niger Delta, and it begs a question that often comes up as we do our job in the news business, which is, why should people care? Why is this important?
The reason we should care is that not only because oil is now $140 or $145 a barrel, of course that's why anyone is interested at all, but do you realize that last year the United States took 50% of Nigeria's oil output? So that right there, in my view, is a reason to care. As a parent, as a citizen of this country, as someone who cares about the world, this situation is unsustainable. What's going on in the Niger Delta, the perverse relationship between the West and now increasingly China and India, as they need more resources, that this situation, this dynamic is unsustainable. We've got to wake up. We've got to pay attention because, frankly, oil, it has a negative impact on the people and on the environment.
Omoyele, let me turn to you and give us a sense of how much oil Nigeria has. I mean, I think now with all of the news coverage of oil, many more people know that Nigeria is an oil-producing state than ever did. But at the same time, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is Saudi Arabia. What's Nigeria's place in this rarefied world?
Well, the best way to put it in this modern day, 2008, is that we have enough oil to attract a wing of the U.S. military, AFRICOM. It is for the sake of the oil in the Gulf of Guinea, which is largely controlled by Nigeria, that the U.S. decided that it's time to have an AFRICOM, that's the African command of the U.S. military. But in terms of mathematics, it's difficult to say because nobody tells the truth about how much oil is pumped out of Nigeria because the oil companies don't want anybody to know. The government, I don't want anybody to know because they steal it. But what we know officially is that we pump out about 2 million barrels of oil on a daily basis. If you multiply that by $146 per barrel, that's a lot of money.
A lot of money.
Yes.
And Omoyele, I was looking at a website that offers you as a speaker for lectures, and it talks about your activism, and then it adds, currently abroad and being treated for the effects of torture Sowore is adamant he'll return to Nigeria. Catch us up on what form your activism has taken and what price you've paid.
Between 1989 and 1999, when I left Nigeria, 10 years period, I spent quite some time in jail, 8 times that I could count. That I spent several days in each of those days. I can't count how many times I got stopped and got beaten up. And on those 8 occasions, I was tortured, heavily tortured. So in 1999, I came to the U.S. and checked myself into the Bellevue Center for Survivors of Torture in New York and stayed there for quite a while trying to take care of my health business.
Do you have hope that this oil will be used for the good of the Nigerian people?
Hope sounds a little bit too religious for me, and optimism sounds a little bit too intellectual for me, but I just think people at this point need will in Niger Delta region of Nigeria and Nigeria as a whole to take back that country from people who run the country, that are military leaders or democratic leaders, and I'm sorry to say the morons who runs the place. So it is just will that I have. It's difficult to have hope in Nigeria. It's difficult to be optimistic in Nigeria, I got to tell you.
Do you blame the West, Omoyele, in the sense that, you know, when the G8 met recently to talk about issues, the Nigerian president brought up oil as a possibly destructive force for all the reasons we're talking about. Do you think that the West needs to step up? And if so, what would stepping up mean?
Well, it's not about stepping up only. It's about taking responsibility for the damages that have been done because people have been hurt over these years. Of course, we blame the West not because it's just very convenient to blame the West. It's because the West's hands have been caught in the cookie jar of human rights abuses in these third world countries, of pollution of the environment, of destruction of, you know, cultures and peoples, of exploitation. These things are well documented. The West has admitted to it. They've admitted to it several times. And when you hear people say we blame the West, it's because the hypocrisy of the West also have come in full circle. For example, you see the Nigerian president goes up to the G8 and says, well, I need assistance to criminalize oil bunkering. You know, that's all he could say. Well, what needs to be criminalized in Nigeria is oil, is the pollution of the environment, destruction of the trees and forests and the ecosystem and the decimation of the cultures of the people, the militarization of the Niger Delta. And the lack of regard for human rights and human dignity is what needs to be criminalized first and foremost.
But just define what yes. Oil bunkering is.
Oil bunkering is like, you know, all these pipelines that are exposed out of lack of maintenance and they bust open. These guys just steal the crude.
You know, I'd like to build on that if I could. That, you know, one of the things we have to remember is roughly 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago, Ken Sarawiwa, a great writer and journalist, Nigerian writer and journalist, he was from Ogoni land and in the Niger Delta. He came and gave the first sort of contemporary expression to so much of what Sowore is talking about, the environmental destruction, the lack of human rights, the lack of, you know, economic equity, all, you know, around oil in the Niger Delta and how it was adversely affecting his people. And what happened to him? The Nigerian government hung him. So if you have and his movement was expressly a nonviolent movement. So this is what happens, right? The ante gets raised. You have this great man who comes along. He says, I'm not interested in hurting anyone, killing anyone. I just want justice for my people and my land. And then the people in power kill him. And then 10 years or more later, surprise, surprise, you have MEND. And you have all these armed groups who now are saying, well, the government and the military doesn't want to talk. They want to fight. Or they actually don't want to do anything. They want to keep the status quo. But that's not good enough anymore. We're not going to stand for it. That's what concerns me about the Niger Delta, is that as long as oil is flowing and so you have this huge booty to sort of fight over or to protect in the case of the oil companies and the government and the military, then the violence will increase.
Enough of grandstanding. We've said this is not going to work. If you pour all the military in the world in Niger Delta region without addressing the injustices that have been done over 50 years, they're not going to stop the militancy. You can't stop a guerrilla war. It's just going to escalate more and more. And white people should care also in this country is that Nigeria has 140 million people. You know, the world, we have to deal with a humanitarian catastrophe that we've probably never seen before in the black world.
I mean, just to pick up on that, think about this. One out of every five Africans is Nigerian.
Yep.
Well, gentlemen, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you for bringing us.
Thank you.
That was photojournalist Ed Kashi. His pictures are featured in the book Curse of the Black Gold. We also heard from Omoyele Sowore. He's an expert on oil in Nigeria and publisher of the website Sahara Reporters. You can see pictures from the book on our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. And next on News and Notes, a look at newsroom diversity. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. The Unity Convention, considered to be the largest annual meeting of journalists around the world, kicks off tomorrow in Chicago. The convention brings together the National Association of Black Journalists, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, the Asian American Journalist Association, and the Native American Journalist Association. This year's theme is A New Journalism for a Changing World. Joining us to talk about the gathering is Unity President Karen Lincoln Michelle. So, Karen, can you give us a diversity report card of how the industry is doing overall regarding journalists of color?
Yes. The Radio Television News Directors Association just released a survey yesterday that showed that there were some slight gains that were made in television among women and minorities. And I'm not sure if that also showed if the workforce is shrinking in broadcast. But there were some gains made there, but it's still below the levels of people of color in the U.S. population. There's a recent employment survey of minorities in the newsroom done every year by the American Society of Newspaper Editors. And this year's showed a very slight increase in the number of people of color in supervisory positions. Now, granted, the whole industry shrank by about 2,400 positions, and nearly 300 of them were people of color. But in this climate, I think you need to build on small gains, like the slight increase in people of color in supervisory positions. On Wednesday evening, during the opening ceremony of Unity 08, we'll be unveiling a new initiative called 10 by 2010. It's a pilot project designed to promote more managers of color into senior management by mid-year 2010. So we're very excited about that because it's a partnership between Unity and media companies to help people of color become part of some of the executive management teams that are reshaping where the industry is going from here. So we need a diverse group of people making those decisions, and this program will help us go down that path.
What's the purpose of a convention like this, which I should say I will be attending? But, you know, it's one of these things where some people go for recruiting purposes. Some people go for, you know, sort of to check in with the state of the industry. What do you think the purpose really is of this convention?
Well, it's really to put diversity, an issue of diversity, in the forefront where it belongs. That's one thing that we're doing. And, you know, it's an opportunity for people of color in the industry to shape the discussions that are taking place about what's happening in the news industry. You know, our theme is about a new journalism for a changing world. And that's where we're at right now, the reality of the industry. And so we're going to talk about that. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that things are changing so quickly with multimedia and, you know, just technology and how that has impacted what we do as journalists. So this is an opportunity for our members to come in and get training if they need training and attend workshops and just help them navigate through all these changes that are happening in the industry. It's also a time for us to reconnect with each other because, you know, we're out there every day working in the trenches, and it's always good to come together and reconnect with folks.
Now, you're a past president of the Native American Journalist Association, and I remember a particular moment at the previous Unity where a questioner from the Native American Journalists Association asked President Bush about tribal sovereignty, and his answer was circular, to put it that way. Is it important for people from the different ethnic journalism associations to be able to talk to the newsmakers who end up coming to these conferences?
Oh, yes, definitely. In mainstream coverage, there's certain questions that are asked, and a lot of times the perspectives of the communities that we come from, those types of questions don't get asked. So this is an opportunity for our members to, you know, ask those kinds of questions that affect the communities where we come from.
Now, Senator Obama is scheduled to address the convention on Sunday. Last week, we spoke to Richard Prince of the Maynard Institute, who said that the presidential forum that was scheduled for Thursday was, quote, all but dead. Of course, Senator Obama is traveling internationally. How did you secure him coming for Sunday? And given that Sunday is essentially the very last day of the convention, do you expect turnout that's going to be significant?
Well, the talks with both presidential candidates have been taking place for a while, and the invitations were extended many, many months ago. And so talks have been taking place, and, with schedules, it's really difficult to nail that down. With this Middle East and Europe trip coming up for Senator Obama, that came into the mix just in recent weeks. It came down to a choice between having the senator come on Sunday or not at all.
So the Senator McCain invitation is still out, but it has not been accepted or rejected?
Right. We're still working on it.
Well, Karen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Karen Lincoln Michelle is the Madison Bureau Chief of the Green Bay Press Gazette. She's also the president of the Unity Journalists of Color Alliance. Darling Hill's powerful jumps and tumbles made her a favorite at the U.S. Olympic gymnastics trials, but shoulder injuries and a sprained ankle dashed her hopes of going to Beijing to compete this year. Hill still has plenty of fans in the world of athletics, and she's here to tell us what's next in her life. And also joining us is Kim Bonus. She's the owner and head coach of the Wilmore School of Gymnastics in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Darling, Kim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
What does it actually mean to try to compete to be on the Olympic team? I mean, how young do you have to start, for example, if you want to compete?
Well, really, most of the girls started at the age of 3 or 4. Darling started at 9, so she was a latecomer to the sport. So it was remarkable as to what she did for this Olympic trials.
Latecomer, that young, it strikes me that there must be an incredible pressure on these kids. And how do you, as a coach, know the difference between a kid who really wants to make it and a kid who's being pushed, for example?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, we look for the athlete with desire, that spunk, that spark, and they really do separate themselves from the other kids. They just have an extra something, which is what Darling had from the day I saw her. She was just an extraordinary talent, very flexible, strong. She had mad ups, as we say, in the sports world.
What about diversity in the sport? I mean, there have been a couple of notable African-American gymnasts, but not a whole lot. How does this sport deal with diversity? And should there even be, you know, outreach, you think, to different communities to get a variety of people from different backgrounds into the sport?
Well, we at Wilmore really do look for that. We have a lot of African-American gymnasts on our team, and we feel as though that if the gymnastics is excellent, the race doesn't really matter. And as far as the judging goes, it used to be in the days that it was something that the African-American athlete did not score what they should score. But the sport has come a long way from those times.
What's the significance of this Olympics for the United States and the world? Because there's been a lot of talk about whether or not political issues, particularly human rights issues, should be a part of the conversation. Do you personally believe that human rights issues should be a part of the conversation that some Olympic athletes have? I bring that up simply because some people have said, okay, athletes don't talk about the political issues. Some are, some aren't.
Right. Well, we've been instructed from the USA Gymnastics president, Steve Penny, basically to stay focused on the sport. It's a lifetime effort for these young people. And in 1980, when we boycotted the Olympics, many athletes were never able to achieve their dream. And we really have separated that as far as from the athlete. We have not even discussed that. Darling and I never discussed this at all. It wasn't part of the plan, so to speak. And maybe that puts us kind of in a bubble. But in order to train the kind of training that these athletes do, there's just no way we can enter the political arena into what we do.
Darling, want to find out what made you want to do this? Because although your injuries prevented you from really competing at the level which you wanted to this time around, you are still a very powerful force in gymnastics. What gives you your drive?
I don't like the feeling of having the regret. So I like to go out and give it 100% every time I compete. And I also had that drive from my coach. So she always gave me the courage, even if I was down or injured. You just always go out and do the best that you can. Don't worry about anyone else out there. We're just going to do what we do, and that's exactly what we did.
You went out to compete in these Olympic trials not so long after your grandmother died, and she played a very important role in your life. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, she was very important in my life. Without her, I wouldn't be here, you know, as anyone can tell you. She was the one I looked up to. You know, she was that person in my life that I can go to for anything, and she's gotten me through everything. She's been through all my injuries, and, you know, I didn't think I can continue. It's still very hard to talk about her.
I'm sorry.
I'm
sorry. I understand that she really not only helped raise you, but was someone who was a light in your life. And when you think about the kind of inspiration that she gave to you, do you think that you are also someone who other people are now looking up to?
Yes, I do feel that, you know, I carry some of her traits through me. I feel it come out, you know, the older I get. The more I speak to people, the more mature I sound. You know, I have a lot of her traits, and I would just want to carry, you know, that throughout my life. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I'm going to come back to you in a second and give you a bit of a moment. But Kim, going back to you, we're all people, and whatever we do, we bring our emotional selves into it. How hard is it, have you seen, for athletes who are under pressure, whether it's the death of a loved one or other pressure, to continue to compete through that pressure, including in games like the Olympics?
Well, I think for someone, I mean, Darling's grandmother was completely her life of her light of her life. And I miss her as well, because when we had our challenges, I would just call her and say, Mrs. Dixon, I need your help. Dar is not where she needs to be, et cetera, et cetera. And we would double team Dar, and we were able to get a lot done together. And she was one who trusted me immensely and gave inspiration to me as well in life. And I feel that for Dar, it was almost unbearable to continue without her.
What's ahead for you, Darling? Do you want to keep competing?
Yes, I have, with the shoulder injuries, I'm going to try to get that taken care of. And I do feel like I can continue in a couple of years. You know, if I want to come back, I know I have the physical strength to, you know, I'm better in the mental area. So yes, I do feel like I can make a comeback. I'll just have to get the same determination and confidence as I had, you know, that I was growing into.
What about an age time limit? Because you know, this is one of those very intense sports that, you know, there's the 41-year-old swimmer who's qualified for the Olympics, but that's a real exception. Many of the sports are ones that are dominated by people who are quite young. Are you concerned that you could age out of this sport before you have the chance to go up for another Olympics?
Not really, because I haven't really reached my peak. You know, my coach never said I reached my peak of gymnastics. I just actually started learning skills, and elite was something new to me. So I know I have a lot more to learn and to get more consistent in my gymnastics. You know, I'm only, 18, but that was, like, the age limit for this Olympics. Now I'll be going on 22 for the next one. You know, my body doesn't feel old at all or beat down. I just feel like I'm just beginning, so...
What do you love about this? I mean, when you think about competing in gymnastics, what is it that fuels you?
The audience. I love, it's not even pressure. It's more like the drive to get out there, and they want to see me compete. They want to see my power and my ability to flip, land on your feet. I think that's more of a drive than getting up there and, you got to hit your routines. I think that's more pressure. So I go out there and I always do the best I can, and I love to hear the audience. And once they get into it, I know I got the key to go out there and, and now I got to impress the judges. So.
And Kim, what do you like the most about being a coach?
I love excellent gymnastics. I am driven by the beauty of the sport and having the athlete mature and grow into understanding what they're capable of. It's the greatest job there ever could be.
Are you going to, either of you, be able to go very, very quickly? Are either of you going to be able to go to Beijing?
No, not me.
Well, hopefully next time around, you guys will both be able to go. And thank you for talking to us.
Thank you for having us.
That was gymnast Darling Hill. She's a member of the USA Women's Gymnastics team. And also joining us was Kim Bonus. She's the owner and head coach of the Wilmore School of Gymnastics in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, Senator Obama continues his tour of the Middle East as Senator McCain speaks out about high gas prices. Our political contributors are ready to give us a roundup of campaign news.